So surprised to see conservative thinkers like James Woods banned from Twitter and Paul Watson banned from Facebook. Donald J. Trump retweeted your tweet. Thank you, Mr. President. Very cool. But while tweets are nice, we need action. A handful of giant corporations have seized control of the new public square and are digitally disappearing dissidents.
That was not John Oliver. That was, in fact, Paul Joseph Watson, longtime editor-at-large for Alex Jones's InfoWars, reacting to the news that he, Jones, Milo Yiannopoulos, Laura Loomer, Louis Farrakhan, and others had been permanently banned from Facebook and Instagram late last week for allegedly violating the company's terms of service regarding hate speech. Watson there was also reading tweets by President Donald Trump, who in the course of his reaction to the news has retweeted white nationalist Lauren Southern and also written the following, and I quote, "I am continuing to monitor the censorship of American citizens," that means all caps when I shout, "on social media platforms. This is the United States of America, and we have what's known as freedom of speech. We are monitoring and watching closely." Hello, everyone. Welcome to the uncensorious weekly editor's roundtable of the Reason podcast. I am Matt Welch, joined by my colleagues Peter Suderman, Catherine Mangu Ward, and the hate speech aficionado Nick Gillespie.
Hi, Matt.
Hi, everyone.
Happy Monday.
Let's jump right into it, even though I kind of have the sensation that Elon Musk's simulation here is starting to repeat itself a little bit too often for my liking. But Catherine, let's start with you and the original Facebook decision itself, because I think it's kind of interesting in the choice of vocabulary. They said that this part violates their terms involving dangerous individuals and organization. Just as a kind of defining our terms here, do you think that Alex Jones, Louis Farrakhan et al. Are dangerous?
They're definitely dangerous under the new definition of dangerous, which is things that make people feel bad. So just to start there, I think that the campaign on the part of a very small minority of activists on college campuses, which has now bled out into the world, to conflate physical safety with emotional well-being has been very successful. And, you know, I do not mean to downplay the actual, the actual harm in the world, which especially Louis Farrakhan has done, but some others on that list as well. At the same time, I think the vast majority of the names on that list are simply assholes and not dangerous. Certainly not dangerous to the extent that they warrant a special ceremonial banning. And, you know, I think it's interesting, and I'm sure we'll get into this, that the secondary story on all of this has been the difficulty in describing what it is that these people have in common, that so many news outlets describe them as far right when that is at the very least debatable, and I would say not accurate. The easy conflation of the terms hate speech, dangerous speech, incitement, and far right, which are all very specific, different things.
Nick, you wrote a piece last week saying that the decision was, of course, well within the company's rights, but unwise. A counter argument to that notion, sort of the Ken Popat White argument, is, hey, isn't freedom of association either a key component of freedom of speech or a kissing cousin to it? What say you?
Yeah, there's no question that it is. But if you talk about this stuff in a larger context, we're seeing globally and at every possible level a real retreat from the idea that the public square, however you define it, and including private platforms like Facebook, but also including Roku or Patreon or PayPal for that reason, there is a global retreat from the idea that we should have a robust public square with lots of participants in it. And Facebook at various points and other social media places, they want to pretend as if they are some kind of public good, but then they also want to always be able to assert their private rights of association, which I totally agree with. And I like I I say, it's, you know, it's within their rights to do it. But we need to build a robust culture of free speech and free expression, and one that tolerates people who we disagree with or who we find distasteful. It's simply not good enough to say that, you know, Alex Jones is obviously an asshole, so we should ban him all the time, because you do start getting into closer and closer, you know, approximations of people who not everybody is going to agree is an asshole. And I don't think it's enough to say, well, you know, Twitter and Facebook and everybody has their, you know, they have their sandboxes. If you want to mix with these people, go ahead. I think that that ultimately is not a a positive way to think about it. And also, like, in the Facebook ruling, they literally said, Facebook said, if you mention InfoWars, you have to condemn the material. Otherwise, you risk being banned. So it's you know, this is a chilling effect, and we should be very concerned about that. We should also be concerned by conservatives, mostly but not exclusively, who are calling for a change in the way social media is kind of not regulated under Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act. Ted Cruz, a variety of other people are pushing for these things to actually be kind of taken over as public utilities, and then having a fairness doctrine that the government would somehow administer be put into place. Also deeply disturbing.
Peter, let's build on that public utility argument. I saw in Alex Jones's reaction to this, he just takes it as a given. Well, you know, Facebook is a public utility, and we're hearing that. It's almost a unanimous chorus, are we not, right now, in terms of federal legislators in Washington. I mean, Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren, if I'm not mistaken, also kind of believe that this should be a public utility. Do you think that that it's kind of like a done deal, at least rhetorically, and or let's say, like, how are those next steps going to be in the conversion of what are private companies into something resembling more public utilities?
They're not public utilities. Facebook isn't a public utility. Just because legislators, some prominent lawmakers are making that case does not make it so. Just because Mark Zuckerberg has occasionally made that case does not make it so. Facebook is a private company. Facebook has the right to ban anyone they want should have the right anyway, for any reason or no reason. And I actually kind of, in terms of your question about what happens next, I think it's a little bit hard to say, because the regulations that that we are seeing talked about most from the Democratic side tend to be about breaking up these big companies and just and requiring them to be separate and smaller. So most notably with Facebook, it would have to spin off Instagram into a separate company. And then there'd be a bunch of other stuff with Amazon, which would have to spin off a bunch of its house brands, stuff like that. That's Elizabeth Warren's proposal. We've talked about it before. And then what Nick said was that you see some movement on the right to treat Facebook, Twitter, et cetera, as public communication spaces. As the new public square is a term that's been used an awful lot, and therefore with a kind of quasi-governmental responsibility to rhetoric. And I think that is wrong and is dangerous. And just because the leadership at these organizations is in some instances stoking that, trying to get legislators to think of them that way, doesn't mean that we should. I also think that any regulations that end up restricting or placing mandates on speech or the ability to control speech are likely to end up at the Supreme Court. And given the way that this Supreme Court has ruled on First Amendment issues, probably wouldn't hold up. But I actually want to just take a little bit of an issue with Nick's idea that this is worrying somehow, because I just don't find this in any way disturbing.
Do you find it
to me the promise of the?
Do you find it at all?
To me, the promise of the internet is not that Facebook has to or even should let anyone on their platform. The promise of the internet is that it is a decentralized platform in which Users and market actors, including Facebook, but also including lots of other social media services, can work out what different types of rules are for different spaces.
So it doesn't bother you.
Organizations are going to produce, are going to come up with different rules, and people are going to flock to
them. It doesn't bother you then that Gavin McInnes, who some of us know, the founder of the Proud Boys, who's off that, but he's been deplatformed on all of the major social media platforms. He can't use PayPal. He can't. I don't know if he can still get. I guess he can still get a internet domain. But that isn't worrying to you. And again, it's not because people don't have the right to do this, but there is a retrenchment from the idea that the public square, you know, and or that public conversation should be pretty wide ranging and things like that. I find that deeply worrying, just in the same way I was reading a piece over the weekend about a trans student at Camille Paglia's University of the Arts, who says that Paglia makes them feel unsafe because merely by being a faculty member there, and that she should be removed or she should somehow have her speech rights curtailed. It's a private university. You know, they can do whatever they want, et cetera. But that's deeply worrying in that particular instance. And I think I think that it does not bode well for the future if, in fact, everybody is going to say, okay, well, just start your own social media platform, start your own system, et cetera. And again, you know, there's a libertarian logic there that's somewhat unassailable. It's also very dogmatic, and it will lead to a even more brittle and kind of fragmented and useless culture of conversation and debate and discussion, I think.
I think you had it right the first time. There's a libertarian logic there that's unassailable. I mean, I really do. I agree with
so
Peter.
So if reason gets canned from Twitter.
I'm just saying,
like, put it this way. So you would welcome the banning of Twitter, a banning of reason from Twitter, because that's within their rights. So we don't get to complain about that.
There's a difference between would welcome and think that it's the available equilibrium that is the best option. So I think that the best scenario would indeed be one in which our culture so deeply values the sharing of disparate opinions that this is not a debate at all. But that's not the world we live in, and I actually don't think that's ever been the world that we live in. And instead, what we are doing right now is once again sorting out the eternal, very difficult question of what private spaces and private conversations and overlapping private spaces look like. And I think the option for exit rather than voice here is the relevant option. I think people can and do all the time. Like, literally, I sit at dinner parties and people say within 5 minutes, one, I don't go on Facebook anymore. I'm so off Facebook. I'm totally done with Facebook. And two, Facebook is a public utility that desperately needs regulation. It is our new public square. Like, people are holding this A and not A in their mind simultaneously, and it's yielding bad results. And so I think that there clearly will always be emergent additional layers in which people like Gavin McInnes can speak. And I also think that individuals can use their tools, including the block button and the unfriend button, to keep Gavin McInnes out of their particular walled garden. And that I think it's acceptable and appropriate if Facebook and Twitter do the same.
My actual opinion is that Facebook should suspend all accounts immediately and forever.
It's the
no exceptions.
Sweet meteor.
You want a Thanos Facebook?
I think there's a meaningful distinction to be drawn between exit and expulsion. And it's not clear, you know, if and
no, but I'm not arguing that Gavin McInnes exercised exit. I'm arguing that because others can exercise exit, the standard for expulsion is lower.
What I'm saying is that if somebody it seems to me that it is a better world if Gavin McInnes and if Watson or InfoWars or Farrakhan are allowed to be on Twitter. Allowed to be on Facebook, and that we're living in a culture where people recognize difference, and anything short of true threats or actual criminal activity, which is itself, you know, seems like a kind of robust or a strong category, but kind of breaks down at the edges. We should be working to have a world in which that is more tolerated rather than less tolerated.
So, I mean, in the case of Alex Jones, there would at least be an argument there. I'm not sure I would buy it, but there would at least be an argument that he is encouraging or facilitating harassment For example,
the harassment, the harassment is illegal, of him like going after it and like, you know, doxing or getting in the face of, you know, survivors of the Sandy Hook.
But his idea that Newtown was a false flag operation with crisis actors that led
ridiculous.
To
it's horrible.
The harassment.
You don't I don't think you want
to
go there.
I don't think you want to go there
because then people saying, you know, when you talk about privatizing health care or getting rid of Medicare or something like that, you're actually calling for the extermination of old people, blah, blah, blah. Like that's this is the slippery slope. Like we're validating the concept of hate speech by saying, and again, Facebook has the right to do it, but I think we should bitch and moan about it, and we should either create
the
a change.
The concept of hate speech is that the government would change the penalty for a crime because of what you were thinking. Does it allow them to create a page?
You don't think it's more likely that when a place like Facebook starts patrolling speech and policing speech, even to where you can't even say, we might not be able to have this conversation on Facebook. Because we're not immediately, as soon as we invoke Alex Jones or InfoWars, we're not immediately saying who is awful and should not be tolerated, et cetera.
If a conversation as close to the mainstream as ours gets booted off of Facebook, then it also will mean that the alternative spaces to have this conversation will immediately become incredibly robust. I think if anything, the Facebook,
so you don't,
Facebook
you don't really
booting
worry.
People off minimizes the chances of government intervention.
Yeah, so, I don't think so, actually. I think what happens when Facebook says, okay, we're using hate speech, and also remember that Facebook right now is also in conversations, you know, actual conversations with the government about regulating.
Right, but
and
we're
regulation.
All against that, right? No one on this podcast is it would be great if Mark Zuckerberg gets to write the laws about hate speech.
He's acting, this is like, you know, this is in the same way, and actually I think it's more pernicious, of the MPAA, the Film Rating Agency, you know, well, they were doing that to forestall government regulation, but that doesn't mean that it isn't a result of threats by the government or collusion between major actors.
But the end of that story is HBO. The end of that story
YouTube. Well, here's a question, Catherine. It doesn't have to be that way. And HBO came into being, cable TV came into being decades after it could have. In a lot of ways, and all sorts of things. So you can
but
say
not because
in the end,
MPAA
no. Well, what all I'm saying is, it's like we can say
a rating system that it policed itself.
We will have a happy ending ultimately because we're all triumphalists, right? We're all technological and market triumphalists, where you know the market finds a way.
Like
but you can waste time, and like you know, I'm 55. I don't have like 30 years for the you know the great workaround on a clampdown. It's the same way, you know, the internet would have grown and it would have been slightly different, but if Section 230 hadn't been written into law and if it hadn't survived a legal challenge that struck down worse parts that were going to regulate the internet, it would have taken 20 years longer for the internet to become what it became. I think we can, from a libertarian perspective, you know, recognize property rights and things like that and still be deeply disappointed with outcomes done by particular platforms, particular corporations, and things like that. And that's what I'm calling for here.
We agree. You know, I'm just not disappointed by this one.
I was on MSNBC this weekend talking about this, and I was on with a couple of left-leaning activists and then also Gabriel Sherman from Vanity Fair. And the activists went first, and a woman whose name I forget was complaining about the ban from the angle of, hey, look, I previously had been banned or suspended from YouTube because I was bitching about white people. I'm summarizing here, bowdlerizing a little bit, the quote here. And so, you know, they in fact have a double standard that has been more in favor of the white nationalists and alt-right group there. They should be using their terms of service and recognizing these violations. It seems to me that we're getting to a point, and I see this on the distorting lens of Twitter on a daily basis, where journalists, including some pedigreed ones, are competing with one another to say, no, this person I don't like violated the terms of Twitter. Jack, when are you going to ban Donald Trump, Jack? Journalists. And I think there's something to be said about, to Nick's point, about that that culture, the culture of looking for the next person to ban, sometimes including politicians. One of the people who banned ran for Nevada Senate, Paul Nehlen. I mean, he's a crypto fascist, but he was a politician, ran for Congress. And there's just everyone just kind of assumes, or way too many people kind of assumes, that this is a valuable and worthwhile activity. And I don't. I think that in itself kind of worries me more than most other things. That's just a statement. I'm going to stop it here because, Catherine, I want to get you to react specifically to something that not Donald Trump said in reaction to this, but that Thomas freaking Massey said here. And I quote, BTW, I've never advocated for regulating social media or the internet, but should FB be free to ban Facebook? I think he means by that. To ban elected officials or candidates for office. They have, in fact, taken down accounts of candidates, unquote. And this is the same Thomas Massey who previously had said that Gary Johnson and Bill Weld were not really libertarian because they wanted to force wedding cake makers to make the gay Nazi cakes. So, Catherine, do you want to express your disappointment or maybe agreement with Thomas Massey?
I am the only true Scotsman, as always, here. Yeah, so, you know, Massey's special pleading for politicians' speech rights is, I would say, 100% precisely missing the point of speech rights, which, of course, were enshrined in our founding documents in order to protect people bitching about politicians, in order to protect criticism of the powerful. That's the origin story of free speech. And, you know, of course, it does lots of other great things as well. There's a reason it's entangled, as you said earlier, with freedom of assembly. There is a lot going on in those wee few words. But Massey, come on, my guy. Like, this is not, your interpretation here is not right. The idea that a private venue, Facebook, would say to a politician, you can't come in here, bro, is not a thing worthy of extra scrutiny. It is not a thing that is so alarming that libertarians need to reevaluate their principles. It is the opposite of that thing, and I am disappointed, my guy.
Suderman,
I'm not angry. I'm disappointed.
Semi-building on that, if I'm trying to guess who gets banned next, Steve King, an actual sitting Republican congressman from Iowa, I think will likely face ban. Ilhan Omar, and I'm mispronouncing your name, sorry about that, actual sitting congressman. And if, as we have seen over and over again on college campuses, who are the some of the most frequent targets of speech kind of codes, it is pro-Palestinian activists, anti-Zionist activists. Does that not worry you, or at least cause you a moment of anything less than triumphalism at Facebook's censoriousness?
I wouldn't say that it causes me any triumphalism. However, it also doesn't worry me.
Okay,
it just doesn't. In the same way that if the Verizon Center here declined to put on a Gary Johnson speech for any reason or no reason because they don't like Gary Johnson's hair. You know what? I would probably complain. Like, I would probably say, you know what, Verizon Center, you should host Gary Johnson. He wants to put on a speech. He's going to pay. Right. On the other hand, like, they have every right to do that. And it's fine.
Gary Johnson won't be able to talk then. Like, that's right? Always the underlying idea here is, like, even if Facebook or a college campus or the Verizon Center throws Steve King off of everywhere, like, this is the whole idea. He can go down on the street corner and talk. He can put up steveking.com. He can
what about if somebody actually can't get a domain name? Like, they can't get
The way that we manage domain names is deeply bizarre.
No, but I'm just saying that any point where there should be again, I'm not saying like a law.
Yeah, the point is public space. That's the line.
I would say that if the government is saying these people can't get a domain name, and or if the government is saying that all platforms have to abide by a certain speech code in which, say, you have to let everyone, I would say it's actually wrong for the government to say that Facebook and Twitter have to let everyone, or have to let everyone who passes a certain test on. And that, to me, is is the kind of the core, like that's the promise of free speech
Congress
on the internet.
Congress shall make no law.
Right. Is that Congress isn't doing it, is that the EU isn't doing it, is that all of this stuff is being worked out between users and the producers of internet stuff, of platforms, the owners Here. And providers. And that is how we work out free speech outside of the government purview, right? Like, it's not that you can go and say absolutely anything you want, any place you want. It's not that there is no cultural expectation that some places are good for certain types of speech and other places are not so good. You can't, for example, go into most restaurants or movie theaters and start shouting that Barack Obama was the greatest president in the history mm-hmm. of the United States, or that Donald Trump really is just his economy. Is it right? You can't do that. That's political speech. And yet we accept that, like, that's not the time and place for it. That is inappropriate. Someone owns that space. They are using it for a particular commercial purpose, and they are going to ask
you
to leave.
Take it
and
back.
If they, and if you don't leave,
back.
Then they're going to make
take
you
it
leave.
Back to the point where you would complain if Gary Johnson was locked out of the Verizon Center or something like that. What do you do to push back against Facebook restricting speech?
Again, this is a thing that their users, they're responsible to mm-hmm. their user base and to their shareholders and to their employees. And that group of people will figure out, I'm not on Facebook, so I am none of those things. And I don't own, to my knowledge, any shares in Facebook. So that group of people will work out what that platform is going to be and what it's for and what the rules are in the way that people have always
yes.
worked out things.
But that's
private
I find
spaces.
That incredibly passive. And in a broader sense, the fight for free
well, it's
speech.
It's not always my yeah, job
no,
to determine.
I, no, I'm not. I'm not saying it is. Let me finish.
Passivity in the face of stuff that's not your business.
No, but it is.
Virtue.
It is our business, because political speech on Facebook is under attack. And part of it is because, you know, they're trying to scramble ways to figure out what accounts are bots and which are allowed, because they're worried about getting regulated by the government because of political ads that may or may not have had any effect on the 2016 election. What I'm getting at here is something that, and it may be orthogonal, or it may be it totally unrelated to kind of libertarian dogma on this, but when you live in a world where the idea of conflict and free speech is under increasing attack, which I think is true, and you see this, other governments are doing things to shut down speech. In the thing I wrote about the Facebook bans, I also pointed out how New Zealand, the media in New Zealand, the government did certain things to ban certain possession of certain videos and books after the Christchurch shooting. The media came together to say, we are going to restrict our coverage of the trial of the mass shooter there. That's the media, private actors acting in a bad way. We're in a world on college campuses where free speech, free expression, academic integrity, and intellectual freedom is under attack. These things move in concert with one another. And that, I think it's a bit glib to be like, well, it doesn't matter because we have our libertarian dogma and it's a private space and everything is okay as long as the private owner gets to do something. Like, we should, let me just finish. It's like, it's, you know, cake bakers have a right, you know, they should have more rights actually to discriminate against whoever they do business with. But it's also the case that, like, I think if you believe in free expression, or if you believe in individual rights, and if you believe in gay rights and equal rights, you should make fun of, you should push back against bakers who are saying, I'm not going to serve these kinds of people for ultimately arbitrary and ridiculous distinctions. Like, we need to have a positive agenda. If we're just waiting until we get kicked off of Facebook, that's going to be too late.
This is a non-rhetorical question. Do you actually think now, compared with, say, 5 years ago and also 20 years ago, that speech is less free?
Yeah, actually, 5 years ago,
that speech
5 years
more
ago,
restricted.
I would say
there are fewer
you asked the question.
Ways
I,
for people to express their
I will,
views.
I will say, compared to 5 years ago, I think it is either flat or declined. Compared to 20 years ago, 30 years ago, 50 years ago, no, absolutely not. I think there are worrying trends.
So I think
there
this
are
is, in part
trends,
here, this is a pure,
but
in part here, this is an empirical question yep. then, because I think that's obviously untrue. I think it's clearly true that the ways, modes, and and venues for expression are continue to multiply rapidly, even as a couple of the large ones.
There are many more outlets, but it does not actually bother you that major platforms are now saying, we're done with certain kinds of speech.
Listen, I sometimes disagree with the individual decisions, but I think the
that's
broad question
arguing.
Of whether that's a threat to the Republic is the answer is
all
no.
Right. Well, we disagree. You know, I think it is a threat. I think it's politics follows culture. And if people get more and more brittle and more extreme about what kinds of, you know, news or images that they might, find on Facebook, that's going to show up downstream. That's going to show up in political action, I think. And this is particularly frustrating because one of the built-in features of social media is that the end user, the particular user, gets to tailor so much of their experience. So what we're seeing at Facebook, and it's not clear that they're responding quite to shareholders or even users asks to get rid of Alex Jones, but they're doing, you know, the people who run it are saying, okay, we're making this bet that this is what most people want. But there's something, you know, it's the easiest thing in the world in social
media.
Isn't
that what business owners
often
do?
Often,
though?
Peter. I mean, but then, you know, like they also often make a lot of bad mistakes, you know, and it's, you know, part of the market process is that you get a lot of feedback, a lot of it unwarranted. We all get a lot of, you know, emails and tweets and people telling us to shut up and die and stuff like that. But sometimes that feedback is actually useful and it's a course correction for dumb corporate policies. And I think banning people like Alex Jones is a dumb policy.
Before we leave the topic altogether, just because Nick used the politics is downstream from culture formulation, I wanted to just throw this out here, and I'll send it to Catherine. What does it say about either politics or culture at this moment, and does it trouble you that in the course of responding to all of this, the president of the United States vigorously retweeting InfoWars and Lauren Southern, praised Diamond and Silk, called James Woods a conservative thinker, and, you know, name-checking Charlie Kirk at every opportunity. Does this bother you?
Yeah, I mean, in this case, I don't know which way the stream is flowing anymore between politics and culture. Like, it's a whirlpool, maybe. It's quicksand. I'm not sure, but... But yeah, I mean, you know, the to me, the seeming confusion on the part of the president, first of all, about who actually holds the true power of censorship between him and Facebook is confusing and disturbing. But also, I mean, the president is essentially embodying the Nick Gillespie theory of discourse here. He's saying that the restriction of certain voices on a private platform is so bad in and of itself, it has such negative consequences that he will amplify these voices as a public service, that he will bring them back to the fore because it's so important that there be this diversity on this platform, which he happens to spend an awful lot of his time on. And I think, you know, I don't want to say Nicholas B. and Donald Trump agree about everything, but
whoa,
if you're going to force me into
wow
it.
Well, I mean, I think Trump is saying something a little different. And he used two words that I want to single out: censorship of American citizens and freedom of speech. Right. He is saying that he is implying from his position as the president of the United States, defender of the Constitution, that the First Amendment...
I legit thought you were going to say defender of the realm, which just shows how deep in I am. Sorry, go ahead.
Certainly. There should be like a 24-hour Game of Thrones and American politics confused allowance
yeah,
here.
I need detox time. Sorry, go ahead.
Right, like, he is saying that from his position as the president of the United States, defender of the Constitution, that, like, free speech rights imply that Facebook should not be able to prohibit people from being on
that's
their
true
private
platform. And Nick is not
platform
saying that. I take
that,
back my utterly unfair baiting.
And what
however
Donald Trump is saying is exceptionally dangerous. And it is a hugely worrying thing to see from a politician that, like, they would assume that that's what free speech rights are. And I think that that is a huge cultural problem we have is that people now seem to think that their free speech rights extend certainly to all social media, but to all sorts of places that are private.
And that's what's embedded in the Thomas Massie thing that Matt read, right? Yeah. Like embedded in the Thomas Massie thing is an idea that somehow there is a something fundamental to the structure of the United States Constitution or our understood free speech law and practice that would require a private actor to give a platform to politicians. And that is deeply wrong.
And in the interest of comedy, I will actually say that I think this is where Nick's point comes in and is good. And like the discussion should be about the culture of discourse and who we are going to, what sort of discourse we are going to allow, accept, encourage, or discourage, and how.
We're saying,
and that is not the conversation.
We need a conversation about conversations about the discourse.
What I am saying.
Barf.
To ban all of you.
Save us, Matt.
If Section 230, of the Communications Decency Act is changed, which it can be done by Congress, people on the right and the left, or liberals and conservatives, Republicans and Democrats, have both talked about doing this. If that changes, it may not destroy the internet, but it will fundamentally change the internet as we know it, and particularly one which is characterized by user-generated comment, which is one of the great liberating things of the internet. So, I think we should really be, you know, concerned about every time people are saying certain types of speech. And also equating speech acts with physical acts or criminal acts or violence and things like that, which is definitely trending upwards across the board. These are not good directions, or these are not good conversations to be having. We should be trying to redirect and change how we think about this stuff.
And to restate the obvious, in case people have forgotten some of the obvious, the president, who is a champion of the freedom of speech, for people who support him and who are getting kicked off of social media platforms, and also has signed an executive order that, in kind of with a vague enforcement, is in the name of protecting or expanding freedom of speech on college campuses, is also the same president who has expressed desire to criminalize flag burning, even though that situation has been solved 30 years ago by the Supreme Court, and also wants to revive the fairness doctrine and the equal time rule and other such things, based largely on his own political and personal dissatisfaction being criticized by certain venues. And he has also instructed his antitrust department Department of Justice to look into antitrust actions against media companies, again, based on content of those companies. And there's been more vigorous enforcement of those than we've seen in generations.
Forget the libel stuff.
And don't forget the libel stuff. And if you want to read more, just
specific targeting of major media organizations.
Open up libel and then go after Jeff Bezos, because why not? Please look at Reason.com, search Jacob Solomon Free Speech, the end. I'm going to once again make one of you. It's either going to be Catherine or Peter. Let's flip that coin. Beep. And it lands. Boop. Peter. This morning.
That's
Matt,
not the sound that coins
what
make.
Currency beeps and boops?
It was a Bitcoin. He flipped a Bitcoin.
You know what I flipped? I flipped because I just saw that movie finally, as I mentioned the other night. The Dark, what's it called? Dark Angel, the Batman movie. Super good.
The Dark Knight.
Thank you.
With a K, Matt.
Got a lot of coin flipping there. I was thinking
welcome
Evil Angel.
To the end of the George W. Bush presidency.
Anyways,
time.
This morning, the Dow Jones Industrial average of 30 of the highest volume traded stocks on the New York Stock Exchange. I didn't get that right exactly. They used to say this on the on KFWB news radio when I was growing up, and it was like a mantra to me going to sleep. Anyways, I'm going into my own fugue state. It opened up 344 points lower than it closed on Friday, and it did so because of two tweets by President Donald Trump. And since we're reading tweets today, I want Peter to sit, get his Zen meditative state, be prepared to listen, and tell us if he can spot anything that's wrong in the following statements. Here they are. For 10 months, China has been paying tariffs, if I do it like that, that means the capital T, to the USA of 25% on $50 billion of high tech and 10% on $200 billion of other goods. These payments are partially responsible for our great economic results. The 10% will go up to 25% on Friday. $325 billion of additional goods sent to us by China remain untaxed, but will be shortly at a rate of 25%. The tariffs paid to the USA have had little impact on product cost, mostly borne by China. The trade deal with China continues, but too slowly, as they attempt to renegotiate. No! So, Peter, just before we get to the wisdom of the policy, do you see anything factually inaccurate in those statements?
Well, Trump continues to think that tariff payments are some combination of deficit reduction and or just profit for the United States, right? So his idea is that the economy in the United States is doing better specifically because of the payments that China is making as a result of these tariffs is not right. That's not how they work, and that's not just not what is causing our actually in many ways pretty good, not all, but in many ways really quite good economy. And so there's that. But I mean, Trump, I think, has taken the wrong lesson from the quite good economic news that we have seen over the last several months and year, and has basically decided that that he's going to double down on the trade war as a result. They're good and easy to win, and they're not.
Insert John Stossel voice here. But Catherine, Trump said this would help the economy, and the economy's been helped. Maybe he's been right and we've been wrong about trade.
Yeah, maybe, but probably not, because there's this question that people frequently, and the president encourages this, confuse the strength of the economy with the exact spot that the market is in at this moment. Also, people who confuse the strength of the economy with the exact spot that employment numbers are in at this moment. I think, you know, what Reason has long argued, and which I believe is deeply true, is that to create a situation of large amounts of uncertainty, including the constant threat of punitive tariffs on our quote-unquote enemies, is there's simply no way that this helps the U.S. in the long run, and that we can see this sometimes in market reactions, but we should not overread those numbers, and that, as Peter rightly points out, it's not as if somehow when you impose a tariff, the money like goes against like eight different deficits in like both our moral character and also our actual like treasury.
It's not like a fee that you get from a hotel room or something, which I think, or like a development deal, which is Trump's mode of thinking about the economy.
Nick, that's his model. Yeah. Nick, I was going to tee this up just by saying that you and I were at the Manhattan Institute Hamilton dinner, and thank you for the invitation, Manhattan Institute. You guys are real mentions. The last week, and in one of the speeches up there, there's a great talk, and you see this at a whole lot of right of center institutions nowadays that posited the essential argument of our times is: are we going to go back to full, or at least democratic socialism? I think the word commies was even used in this sense there. I suspect in my dark heart that in addition to that being a very legitimate worrying concern about economic policy trends on the left, that there's also a sense of right of center relief in a sense, because this allows you to be pro-Trump, even though he's taken the party completely away from its anti-government spending rhetoric and anti-trade actual or or pro-trade actual policies, which is a throat clearing way of saying, do you think like that pro-trade GOP is like dead?
Yeah.
Has it been killed off?
I think so, because at the GOP, not among economists and not among people who are, you know, serious interested in policy. But the GOP has shown, and this is one of the great clarifying lessons of Trump, is that the GOP really didn't believe in anything. We knew under, you know, because of Bush in the early part of the century, we knew that they weren't serious about limiting government and cutting government spending and the size and scope of government. But, you know, he really kind of puts a button on it. They didn't have any, they don't have any real beliefs other than those that they figure will keep them in power or get them back into power. So, you know, and I also think more broadly, because on the, you know, it's also important to recognize that there was a consensus briefly held in the Democratic Party. And, you know, you saw this in the Clinton years towards free trade as an economic benefit for both the people we traded with, but more importantly for Americans and American consumers and American workers. That, you know, the Democratic consensus faded first, but the Republican one has now. And it's really incumbent upon people, I think, who believe in free trade and what it represents and both what it delivers. Like, we need to remake this case. And it's kind of tedious because every generation you have to remake all of the cases that you thought, all of the arguments that you thought had been won for good. I mean, coming out of the mat, and I suspect without just pawning it off on generational differences, you and I tend to be more aligned on free speech issues. And it's partly because we came out of a period, you know, through the 70s at the very least, where free speech had really become a kind of dominant value that everybody shared pretty much, with the exception of really censorious right-wing conservatives who were worried about pornography and bad words on TV. That consensus is gone. People don't think that way anymore. It needs to be refought. I think the same thing is true of trade, which had an even more spectacular win. It took decades to create a consensus where everybody agreed, not just economists, but everybody agreed that free trade was a beneficial policy. That doesn't exist anymore. And that won't, it, when Trump disappears, the free traders in the Republican Party won't start snapping back, because they don't really care about that. All they care about is whatever instrument they can have at hand in terms of a policy or an attitude that will get them into the next election.
So, speaking of the Democratic Party, last week, as is pretty much the case of every week, we had a handful of new presidential candidates throw their hat in a ring, which now includes something like 22, 23, 24 total people running for president. So let's do a quick lightning round of meet your new presidential candidate on the Democratic side. Catherine, I want to start with you. I understand that.
No, don't start with me.
That the sheriff from Deadwood is running for president. Is that true? No?
Maybe. I don't even know anymore. I didn't do my homework. The Washington Express, like the giveaway that they give people in the metro, that's published by the Washington Post, literally has on the cover of it like all the candidates, and it's like a how many can you name quiz. So that's,
it's like the end of Avengers Endgame.
Exactly.
Yeah. But I could name all of them, and I don't know about
unfortunately,
this.
Unfortunately, too many will survive the 2020 primaries, Peter.
So his name is Seth Bullock. He's the governor of Montana, and he is, compared to the field, a centrist. Peter, who's – I didn't even know that there was another – that Colorado had two senators. But, one of them is running for president?
it's true, actually. Like many states, Colorado has two senators.
Almost all of them, really. Yeah,
it's actually pretty average in that respect. And one of them is running for president. His name is Michael Bennett, and he is also a centrist who really thinks that Washington has messed up a lot of stuff, and that it is that lawmaking in Washington is dominated by people, he has basically said, who are sociopaths. And it's actually reminds me a little bit of what Nick just said about how Trump has shown that the Republican Party doesn't really believe anything at all except whatever they need to say to stay in power. That is something like the argument that Michael Bennett is making and has made. He basically says, well, look, these people don't really believe anything at all, and they're offering crazy, stupid policies that won't work. In particular, he's actually gone after the Democratic Party's left flank and Bernie Sanders' Medicare for All policy. However, he's not that libertarian. I would definitely not describe him as a libertarian. He is simply he is an anti-socialist, is maybe the right way to put it, who has instead offered his own Medicare policy called or healthcare expansion policy called Medicare X, which is a public option, a government-run second option to that would work alongside of Medicare and the Obamacare exchanges. It's not a great idea, but it does score well at the CBO.
Nick, there's another Colorado centrist running for president.
That was an extremely Suderman wrap-up of a point, by the way. Can I interrupt
but that's
you briefly,
Democratic
by the way?
Centrism in 2019, right? It's like Bernie Sanders is crazy. So let's do this other thing that is also an expansion of government and not great, but scores really well with the CBO.
At least someone somewhere did math that sort of the numbers add up.
And I think, you know, it's worrying in a different way. On the other hand, relative to the like full socialism agenda, I'll take it.
I just want to jump in here and say that I obviously actually definitely didn't do my homework, but also have never seen the show Deadwood and legit had no idea what you were talking about and did not know
Isn't
anything about
Deadwood
actual Deadwood
Dakota?
Either.
It is, but the sheriff.
I legit thought
Seth
you might be telling me that Ian McShane was running for president because that's what 2020 is like.
I don't know. Wasn't he born?
That guy's running.
Born in a foreign country.
He looks like such a villain. Maybe he's exactly what we need.
Yeah, it's a.
I just like Googled to understand what you were talking about, and I now want to say I'm more confused.
Can we say Ian McShane words on this podcast? Are we censorious of ourselves or not?
We can say all the
Ian
McShane words.
So, like, I mean, it is like a glorious kind of image to like consider Ian McShane as the Deadwood bar owner that he didn't play the sheriff, and like his profanity was just elaborate and exquisite. That was what he
like the president's Twitter feed could be better, and it would be if it was run by Ian McShane as his Deadwood character.
He called everyone a cocksucker.
Yeah,
and like just think about the Ian McShane as Deadwood guy debate versus Donald Trump. And
I want to confess here now that I once wrote a piece for Salon that I should be shamed for forever in 2003 or 4 called Deadwood Democrats.
Yeah.
Nick, speaking of dead Democrats from Colorado, you read
that is such a 2003 Salon era headline.
I know, Jesus Christ. And I wrote it too. You read a thing by John Hickenlooper in the Wall Street Journal. What did it say?
Yeah. Former governor of Colorado who is running as a centrist, and he it says specifically that he's running to save capitalism and that he, again, as Peter was pointing out, he kind of waves away the socialist left, the democratic socialist left of the Democratic Party. But he also says there has been too much dangerous deregulation and free markets breaking out on the right. So he recognizes that income inequality and lack of uplift for the vast middle class in America is threatening capitalism because if capitalism is perceived as not working well and people aren't getting ahead en masse, then they call for crazy solutions such as most of the people that are running as Democrats are proposing now, more government takeover of everything. I don't think he has any, any chance going forward. But I do think his argument or the beginning of his argument that there is a widespread sense that capitalism has failed, what we consider market capitalism in America over the past couple of decades has failed. And it's worth actually taking that anxiety seriously. And also finding out empirically if it's true. I actually don't think it's true, but I think it's part of a piece with a bunch of narratives we're telling ourselves. Student loan debt is another one like this, where we're telling ourselves that the economy has never been so awful for so many people and that, middle class people and even upper middle class people haven't gotten a pay raise in, 30 years, et cetera, and that there's no way to get ahead. There are no jobs left. And this is before the robot takeover happens, et cetera. We need to actually kind of dig into that and to see if any of it's true. And if it's not, we need to articulate and circulate the actual reality that most people are living in, which is vastly better than it was 10 years ago or 20 years ago and certainly 30 or 40 years ago. And then beyond that, we have to talk about how, his subhead is massive deregulation. And socialism would both ruin the economic system that allows America to flourish. There hasn't been massive deregulation of the economy. There wasn't massive deregulation before the financial crisis, and there's only more re-regulation after the financial crisis. And we need to kind of really confront that and understand that, I think, to have any possibility of having a free market system that's actually free and will generate much more wealth than it's doing.
And of course, the next Democratic entrant, as far as we know, is going to come this week. New York Mayor Bill de Blasio. And this fills me with nothing but mirth. There never has there been, I don't think, a politician more hated by the city that has elected him by 50 and 40 percentage points, respectively. He is a buffoon. New York City is losing population 2 years in a row for the first time, I think, since the 1970s or maybe early 80s. It's just not a well-governed city in any respect. His people are constantly covering up, like, his car crashes. He bitches and moans about global warming while getting, like, police escorts to take him from Gracie Mansion to Jim Epstein's YMCA to work out at 9 o'clock in the morning. He's just awful. And everyone looks forward to him being humiliated to a national stage. I like that. There's, I think, a Politico article that quoted a bunch of his current advisors, including one of them who characterized this run as, quote, fucking insane.
I hope he discredits by association a bunch of positions that have become, you know, kind of standard among Democratic candidates.
Yeah, like, let's ban glass and steel skyscrapers, which is a great idea in the city of New York. What a clown pants. Let's go to our fabled end of podcast. What have you been consuming? I'll take the DC contingent here. Flip your own Dark Angel coin and figure out which one of you is going to say the thing about the TV show.
I was not going to say the thing about the TV show, so I'll go first and let Peter make his own life choices. But I was going to recommend another podcast, the Pessimists Archive podcast. It's so good, you guys. It's hosted by Jason Pfeiffer, who is the editor-in-chief of Entrepreneur Magazine. He also has another podcast that's called something corporate, Problem Solvers, where he interviews CEOs. But don't listen to that one. I mean, that one's fine. But the one you should listen to is The Pessimist Archive, which is just what it sounds like. It is deep dives. I'm sorry, but that is the correct term for this, even though it's a cliche. Deep dives into stuff where people really freaked out about it initially because it was going to ruin everything that turned out to be fine. So there's an episode. The most recent episode is about the waltz. Fun fact.
What?
Waltzing was going to ruin everything.
Yeah.
But also
waltzing specifically. Like, yeah, other dancing was fine.
Yeah. Well, no, other dancing was also suspect. But in particular, the quote, which is on the summary, is the dance was in the early 1800s referred to as an obscene display confined to prostitutes and adulteresses. So just keep that in mind when next time you're waltzing. Other episodes include The Telegraph, Chain Stores, The Novel, Electricity, Margarine, etc.
What if you combined all those things?
That's a fun time right there. Electricity, margarine, chain store waltzing. Yeah.
And a novel.
I'm here for it. Anyway, it's a great podcast. It's extremely up the alley of, like, Nick's angry optimism from earlier. Like, what did you say? Triumphalist. It's a triumphalist podcast, and you will love it if you like reason.
Nick?
Last night I watched Game of Thrones, a TV show, which I just stumbled across. I hadn't really heard about it before. But
you just hit the daily double, Matt.
Bar Rescue, I was going to watch that on demand after, so... but I have been watching a lot of Bar Rescue as well, which is a great show where an angry bar owner goes in and cleans up bars that are about to fail for various reasons. But no, Game of Thrones, I watched pretty religiously last night, and I'm finally looking forward to the next episode.
Do you want to tell us in 30 seconds or less what was interesting and good about this
one? Well, Cersei comes back, and, like, that's the only reason to keep watching at this point. And there's a good death, a very kind of dramatic death, and it sets the scene for a final battle, and then it gets back, as Robbie Suave in his last couple of summaries has talked about, it's getting back into the political kind of dimension and the philosophy of, you know, who is the best ruler, or what makes the best ruler. And, you know, there's the consensus among two of the main advisors that the best ruler is the one who doesn't want to actually be king, which is kind of nice.
I will just point out here that one of my best band names back in college was The Reluctant Surgeons. Peter, what have you been consuming?
Also watched Game of Thrones, but I mostly just recommend that you read Robbie's piece, which is very good and gets at all the relevant information. I watched North by Northwest, which I had not seen probably in 10 years, maybe longer than that. And it's like not news to
anyone.
North
by Northwest is good, you guys?
It's not just good. It's a freaking masterpiece. It's really like, so there's that old.
Next week, Peter will tell us his insights on Casablanca.
No, but there's that old saying that like a great movie is like two, or I can't remember if it's two or three good scenes and no bad ones. And that's what North by Northwest is, right? It has a couple of just exceptionally memorable kind of era-defining scenes, in particular the crop duster sequence out at the crossroads, and then a whole bunch of scenes that work very well and do everything that they're supposed to do. And because of that, because the movie's like sort of the average quality, like their floor for quality is very high, and then occasionally there are these like incredible peaks of just kind of pure pop cinema genius. That's how you make a classic. And it's also, it's fun to watch that crop duster sequence now for two reasons. One is, I don't think even in my early 20s, I really understood how much Steven Spielberg was borrowing over the course of his whole career from how Hitchcock conducts his really big set pieces, just in the ways that he sets every little thing up almost in the first 5 or 10% of the scene. And then everything that that happens later flows from the little bit of information that you get in the first couple of shots. It's actually like writing a good intro to a magazine feature or to a piece of journalism, right? Everything, it sort of gives you all of the crucial information right up front and then extrapolates. And then the other thing that I noticed was just how modern it felt in so many ways, and sort of how much of the movie it sort of seems to, right? Like, I mean, it just seems to have like kind of become part of the DNA of Hollywood in ways that we don't think about. In particular, the new yet unreleased Star Wars film. If you Google Star Wars trailer, North by Northwest, you will actually see a whole bunch of shots that J.J. Abrams appears to have not ripped off, but heavily borrowed from North by Northwest to put into Star Wars, just because Hitchcock was inventing the language of film, and people are still speaking his language.
It's a celebration of a pre-Amtrak passenger rail system that I think every libertarian can get behind.
That is,
although there are red caps that like and red caps actually figure into the plot in.
Well, but red caps were private before they were public, Peter.
Let's,
as they should always be,
also point out the great gay subtext henchman, which is something that we didn't see a lot of in movies of the era, which is great. And that Eva Marie Saint and Joanna Andreessen, they're a little similar there. Look for it next time. Facial similarities of the two.
I like it that you're calling out on a podcast to the looks of someone that none of our listeners have any occasion to ever see.
Untrue.
Because she's the art director of a print magazine.
Untrue. I have been reading the beginning of a book that I heartily recommend to anyone who's interested in the subject matter. It's called Begin the Begin, REM's Early Years by Robert Dean Lurie. It's a really fun book. Basically about that. It's written. There's been plenty of biographies, probably too many, of this particular band, kind of the fathers of modern college rock and alt rock. And he rightly points out that those biographies are mostly written by Brits. And using the long arc of the band's career, he decides instead just to sort of drill down into the Athens, Georgia indie scene. The author himself sort of followed them, or like he attended University of Georgia and lived in Athens about 10 years later. But it's just super fun rock writing and historiography, and a pleasure to read. And if you like both the band, but also kind of a snapshot of what it was like to try to acquire music or to as a consumer or to kind of create scenes, the whole bit, and like the self-mythology of bands is always hilarious to me. Really good fun.
Did they peak with Chronic Town, Matt, the EP?
No. I'm a first four REM record. Mm-hmm. guy, and we'll admit that one or two of the ones after that were pretty good too. But that is an opening salvo of a career that's pretty hard to match. And that's it. Thank you for listening to this Editor's Roundtable Reason podcast. I think someone just opened up their first beer of the day over there. Please subscribe to us if you don't already, and leave comments where that is appropriate. And we'll catch you again next week. Goodbye.
I think you may have found it, finally, the book that I am least likely to ever read.